Good evening. Dr. Angela Plea Harrison was hired in August 19 to be the superintendent of Winston-Salem. She was officially sworn in on September 3rd. She's the first African-American and second female to serve in this capacity. Dr. Harrison has endured a long and successful career in public education, spanning more than 30 years in Virginia and Georgia. Since 2014, she has served 31,000 students as superintendent for the Richmond County Schools in Augusta, Georgia. Prior to assuming her current position, Dr. Harrison served as a region superintendent and principal for the DeKalb County School District, Georgia's third largest. She also previously served as director of human resources, a principal, and an assistant principal for the Gwinnett Public Schools, Georgia's largest school district, and as a principal and assistant principal for the Danville Public Schools in Virginia. Dr. Harrison began her career in public education as a math teacher in Virginia Beach in Danville, Virginia. Dr. Harrison has an impressive academic background. She received a bachelor's degree in mathematics and business management from Averett University in Danville, Virginia. She went on to earn a master's degree in secondary school administration from Hampton University, and a doctorate in educational leadership from Virginia Tech. Dr. Harrison also was selected to participate in a prestigious Board Superintendent Academy in 2018. She is married to Lieutenant Colonel Ronald D. Harrison, Deputy Chief of Danville Police Department. My next guest, Dr. Erica Williams, joined Winston-Salem State University as the Associate Dean of Education, Quality Assurance, and Community Engagement as of July 1. She is a former public school teacher, brings more than 22 years of higher education experience and leadership to WSSU. She most recently served as the Associate Dean for the College of Education at Fayetteville State University, her alma mater. She's led efforts to transform programs for the North Carolina Department of Public Instruction and their move towards the 2019 teacher residency model. She also facilitated reform efforts and protocols to build the unit's sufficiency towards success with the Council for the Accreditation of Education Preparation. Dr. Williams has a proven track record for transforming educational programs and developing educators. That's what Dean Darrell Scriven said at WSSU. I am confident, he said, that her vision and leadership will reestablish WSSU's education program as one of the top programs in the country. A native of Windsor, North Carolina, she earned her bachelor's degree in elementary education and a master's degree in special education from Fayetteville State University. She received her PhD in teacher education from the University of North Carolina at Greensboro. Everyone, welcome our guest tonight to Future Focus. We are delighted to have two accomplished and outstanding individuals to talk about education tonight. Dr. Harrison, Dr. Williams, welcome to Future Focus Now.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
We are glad to have you. We are glad to have you, Dr. Harrison, because I know school just started yesterday. And I said, I don't think I'm going to be able to get Dr. Harrison on the show. But you are here. It says a whole lot about who you are and your dedication. Thank you for joining me tonight.
And I'm glad to be here, and I'm glad that we're color coordinated. Did you realize that?
Well, absolutely. You knew you were coming on Future Focus Now, WSSU, so you have red and white, and we're glad to have you. We also got Dr. Williams with us. She's brand new, joined the university July 1st. We're glad to have you. Did you hear all those things that Dean Scriven said about you?
I know. It is incredible. He's been wonderful to work with, and I am honored and humbled.
But he said you were going to transform the teacher education program at Winston-Salem State University. Are you ready for that?
Let's hope. Absolutely. Absolutely.
I know that you are. Thanks, both of you. I've been really excited about this show. There's so many things I want to ask the two of you, and hopefully we'll get through most of those. But I want to begin that the two of you, as I read your bio and the things that you have done, you are teachers. I mean, you started out teaching. My mother-in-law was a teacher. My wife was a teacher. My daughter is a teacher. Teaching and teachers are in my blood. I am who I am today because of teachers. Talk a little bit about your time as a teacher and how it prepares you for what you do today. Dr. Harrison.
Well, I'll tell you that as a high school student, I wanted to be a teacher. But I'll tell you, I was discouraged from considering teaching. And I didn't enter teaching right away. I went into corporate America for just a tad bit of time before I realized that I was not happy. Because I was told that, you know, you make more money, that's where you want to be. So I really went against what I felt I wanted to do as an individual. And after spending a little time in corporate America, I realized not happy. And so I had the opportunity to teach, start my teaching career in a place, little town, Halifax County, Virginia. I went to Hampton University to secure my teaching credentials because at that time I had to go lateral entry because again, I just kept going against what I really felt I wanted to do, just listening to other people. And when I entered teaching, I'll never forget my first contract, $14,995.
Then you wanted to go back to corporate America, right?
Well, I did, but you know, when I walked in that classroom the first week, I fell in love with my children and I just loved my children for all these 35 years. I have not looked back, not once. No matter, you know, there've been hard times with the dollars because public education is not funded the way we know it should be. But I can tell you, oftentimes when we're chasing that dollar, it's not the right thing for us. We have to go with our passion. And that's what I decided to do in life, is to stick to my passion, regardless of the dollars and what people had to say. And I encourage young people, just don't listen so much to the naysayers, because I did for a minute. But once I got into my passion, I tell you what, I haven't looked back, and I've loved every minute that I've spent in education.
I'm curious, you said you knew you wanted to be a teacher in the 10th grade. How did you get there? What were you watching? What were you seeing?
I had great teachers. And my aunt was a teacher. And I so much wanted to be like them. But I also had people in my life that summed or equated the teaching experience to the dollar. And they were discouraging. Oh, you have so much more potential. You shouldn't be a teacher. And that was just the wrong thing to do to a young child who really wanted to teach children. And I tutored. I was always good at mathematics. So I tutored students. And I just got so much out of it. Even through college, I tutored. But I did find my way back to education. And I can tell you that when I'm out and about, I encourage anyone who's interested in teaching young people, follow your passion. Don't listen to the naysayers. You'll love it. You'll love every minute of it. And if you love it and you're passionate about it, all the challenges, you know, you'll work through them.
Absolutely. How does that resonate with you, Dr. Williams?
Well, I think much in the same vein that it was a calling that was always there. I can say that by contrast, I started telling the teachers of my preschool. I was in our county's first attempt at an integrated preschool in the 70s. And I told my teachers and my parents, I was around four, that I wanted to do what they did all day. And if you look at the yearbook from that year, we were the first little inaugural class that finished. There were these Polaroids, because that was what a yearbook was made up of then. And underneath the teacher's caption, that Erica likes taking care of the other children.
Hmm.
And I've never strayed from that. From day one, I just always enjoyed the classroom. And I knew that I wanted to do what those teachers that I sat beside in class did every day. But in some ways, just like Dr. Harrison, by the time I got to high school and started working with guidance counselors, I will never forget there was one counselor that didn't necessarily discourage me from teaching, but told me I had the kind of potential where I could look beyond an HBCU.
Hmm.
And that stuck with me. And so because I had acceptances all over, it affirmed for me that I was making the right decision to choose an HBCU to study teaching. I had to prove something at that point. And so I came straight into an elementary education program and never looked back. Very traditional route to the classroom, and knew that I also wanted to start my career in a rural setting, in a more small, tight-knit community, much like the one I came from. So I started my career in Sampson County, teaching the Clinton City Schools.
Oh, really?
I was in Clinton City Schools at Butler Avenue School with Linda Brunson, was my principal when I started there.
Oh, yes. My goodness. I mean, that's home for me.
You're from that area.
No, I'm from Ivanhoe.
But, yeah, I know where that is. Yeah. So I started teaching there. Very tight-knit community, and resembled a lot of what made classrooms and schools feel familiar and comfortable. Incredible experience, incredible students and community there to serve. Always knew I wanted to be a teacher.
Yeah, I mean, it is indeed. And I was thinking today, when I was in school, and I grew up in certainly rural Sampson County. I mean, you were in the city. I was in the country, so to speak. Teachers were looked upon as being the leaders, you know, in that community. They were admired and they were put on a pedestal. Folks, yes. Really, if you were a teacher, you were somebody, at least when I grew up. I'm curious as if that was your perspective in terms of growing up. And I'm wondering, in fact, what is the perception that people have about teachers today? And are they still looked upon the same way? And if not, you know, how will we get that back?
You know, I'll say that certainly for me, it started there in that preschool. It was affirmed kindergarten through 12th, but it was also affirmed in my community, just like you said, Chancellor. In my immediate community, my Sunday school teachers, the people that I saw at the grocery store, at the post office, they were teachers, they were superintendents, they were people that carried themselves a certain way. They were the individuals that all of the parents in the community respected. When those teachers spoke, when those teachers gave advice or suggestions, the community listened and they wrapped around them. There was a mutual, dual, reciprocal respect between parents and teachers and families, and there wasn't a dividing line. And so there was a lot about that, of course, just seemed very attractive to me. Mm. And I thought that I wanted to be a part of that system where they were honored. Unfortunately, the messaging did shift even in undergrad, just like Dr. Harrison. As an education major, there were lots of projects, there were lots of hours. And my friends that were majoring in accounting and business were often saying, You're smart, Erica. You can come over. Why are you still doing all that work? You're not going to make any money. You know, so the messaging had shifted when we got in college, and those who can do and those who can't teach. That mm-hmm. was some of the mixed metaphors that I started hearing at that point. Interestingly enough, a lot of those individuals have found their way to the classroom. A lot of them had a calling. Don't you know that, Dr. Harrison?
Yeah.
A lot of them had a calling and a tug. Yeah. And a something there that they were denying in search of the dollar. And what most of them have found is that you can have a sound career. There's a trajectory for growth if you want to pursue that. There are lots of opportunity, and no other profession, absolutely no other profession, will allow you to have the impact for generations the way that this profession does. My former superintendent sent me a note a couple of nights ago to say he was proud of me when he found out that I accepted this position here at Winston-Salem State. He was honored and revered in our community for generations. And to get that kind of affirmation, even at this age, it meant a lot. It meant a lot.
And I'm going to say for me, I saw a shift in how we view teachers. It was right when the No Child Left Behind legislation became, you know, was passed. And we went into this craziness around accountability. I believe in accountability. I believe in measuring our work. But I saw a shift in educators. We became, before, and I was in the business, you know, the education field way before. And I felt a sense of ownership to my students. I felt a mother figure as an educator, even as a principal. And it was about having relationships and moving children along the continuum. It was a different time. And since 2001, I can tell you that that the classroom has shifted. There's more focus on, you know, this all this incredible pressure put upon children, where we sifted and sorted children and called them failures in some situations, and they're certainly not failures. Children are learning more now than, my goodness, that the mathematics they learn in fifth grade, I'm embarrassed to say, I taught in ninth grade. Yeah. And, you know, so I know we need to push as a society, but I think we pushed in the wrong way in a lot of ways and lost that human touch, that kindness that we have toward our students and our parents.
Yeah. Now, don't tell me it has changed that much, because I'll tell you, I have grown children now and I struggle with third grade. I mean, trying to teach them, I gave up. It was too complicated for me. So I agree. Don't tell me they're learning even more today than they were 3 years ago.
It is amazing. It is amazing.
Absolutely.
Fantastic. Well, now you have, you know, you're doing great work in your profession. I want you now to tell us, or tell our audience, like what you do. Now, we know and we hear a lot about a superintendent, Dr. Harrison. We hear that a lot. Tell our audience what you do, what your day is like, and who you oversee, and what are your responsibilities as superintendent.
Well, obviously, it's a long day. My team said, thank goodness she has a Zoom call so we can go home. But we have very long days, and it's all good work on behalf of children. And, you know, as a superintendent, I work for Board of Education. 9 wonderful ladies who care about children, who've been elected by the community to oversee the work in the district. And so my job is to ensure we have a good strategic plan to have student achievement, and to ensure we fulfill all those needs behind supporting children, to work with our community, people such as yourself, colleges and universities, to provide the best for children, to pay attention to curriculum, ensure we pay attention to our budget, and all things leadership, constructing schools. You could be one day talking about building the gym at Wiley, and the next minute we're speaking to support services for our exceptional education children. So it's a wide range of activities, but I have a great staff and a great board, and that makes the job still fun.
Yeah. Look, I can tell you that we're glad to have you in the city, and we're glad to have you at the helm of being the superintendent. You know, you've only been here a little while, but you made a big difference. When I travel throughout the city and the county and around, everybody talks about the great work that you're doing. And you've come here and you've established some very strong partnerships. And I want to get into partnerships a little bit later, but I think that's important as well. Dr. Williams, you're a dean at a college. What is that like?
Well, you know, in educator preparation, we are closely aligned to staying current with what Dr. Harrison and her teams are doing in the respective LEAs or local education agencies all across the state. Every day, we're preparing teachers to be day one ready to step into her classrooms and to lead and be in front of other people's children all day. And so that means making sure that our curriculum that we're teaching teachers is aligned to the current standards in the field, that we're following the standard course of studies and making sure that those who are leaving are ready to do that new math, if you will, that's going on. We also are constantly making sure that we're staying in touch with the policies from the State Board of Education. It is our responsibility to make sure that our candidates are aligned and ready with the many assessments and the ways in which they have to show that they're going to be effective in the classroom. So we're preparing for national performance assessments like the EdTPA, which gives a district, a principal, a snapshot of who this teacher is or who they're going to be, because it's video based and this candidate has shown some recorded teaching they've done. They've analyzed it against national metrics. And this person can show, okay, this is what I will do when I'm in the classroom. we are also working on collaborations, these partnerships that you mentioned that we're going to talk about later, making sure that we're staying aligned with what our partners in the community need, what those families need, and that our candidates are responsive and aware of how to rise and meet those needs and trying to honor what students need every day in the classroom. So also securing funding, working with national partners and regional partners to get some much needed dollars and resources to fill in the gaps in places where we may have those. So from securing funding to working through our curriculum and making sure that candidates are being prepared, making sure they're digitally proficient so that they can lead in these ways that particularly now in this remote learning environment, they're ready to lead day one. And then something you mentioned earlier is critical as well, that social emotional piece, you know, making sure that our candidates have that EQ that they need to be able to step in and respond to the different emotional and social needs that our students have in the 21st century. It doesn't exactly look the way it may have looked 10, 15, 20 years ago. And so what does it mean to be day one ready to inherit a child in a social, emotional way that is responsive and affirming? So lots of things to keep on our plates here in educator preparation.
Absolutely, and thanks for that. Let's talk a little bit about the pipe line in terms of looking at getting folks to come into the teaching profession. What is interesting, I think, about HBCUs, many of the HBCUs in North Carolina began, you know, creating and developing teachers, you know, Teachers College. It was actually, you know, it was, what's to say, you know, it's TC, Teachers College. And likewise at Fayetteville State, and likewise at Elizabeth City State University. And you would be hard pressed to go around in this state and not have one of your teachers being a graduate from one of these institutions. And so they were at the forefront. And now many of the teacher education programs across the state are struggling just a little bit in terms of interest. And we know we need diversity in the teaching profession. So talk to me a little bit about what some of the needs are, Dr. Harrison. How do we get, say, more men? You know, we hear the conversation about getting more men to come in there, African-American males to come in. Talk a little bit about the pipeline and the needs that we have today.
Well, I think that's twofold. I think it's getting our young people to be interested in education, but once they accept the opportunity, it's to support our young people as they enter education. Oftentimes, I feel that support is not there in a way it should be, and they feel isolated, especially when we hire our young men at the elementary level. They truly feel isolated and oftentimes leave the profession. So I believe that we must, and we will start, we had a great big plan here before COVID, but we really are planning to have a focus, to focus our children's efforts in elementary and middle and high school on careers and especially educational careers. And those careers around things, all education, we're looking at expanding. A lot of our students feel that it has to be nursing, or they have to be in the field of law or those kinds of fields. And we want to open their eyes to many, many more opportunities, including education. So as I was discouraged as a young girl from entering education, I really want to be that person responsible for having a system to encourage our young people, including our young men, into going into education. And then once our young folks are in education, then we need to encourage them and support them and mentor each and every one of them. We also can't exclude individuals who've been in a career and who'd like to consider education. We must expose individuals who might be interested in educating our students to the opportunities that exist and excite them about education. And so those are some plans we have in our district for recruitment, but we are tremendously short young men, especially African-American men. We just, it's hard to get those young men into education. And quite frankly, they have so many other opportunities pulling at them. So we've got to get ahead of those other opportunities and speak to them about the joys of being in education. The education, my stepson actually just took a job in the school system in Virginia, and he's so excited. But again, he had many, many opportunities knocking at his door. And so we have to encourage our young people.
Thank you. Dr. Williams.
Yeah, I would agree. You know, I think making sure that the profession is marketed as attractive. A couple of years ago, the NEA pulled a bunch of us to DC HBCUs to talk about the rebranding of this profession, particularly for individuals of color and men of color, and what they were going to work with us on to do just that. Because just like Dr. Harrison mentioned, there's so many opportunities pulling at those who are capable that we have to make sure that we make this opportunity attractive, visible, and I would add, reduce barriers. We know on the front end, on the traditional route, there are quite a few requirements that in some ways have been barriers and are not necessarily predictive of what makes an effective teacher. So I know that we've been working within the state and across the nation to look at some of those ways in which we can remove barriers that need not be. I think the other piece that Dr. Harrison mentioned, which is so critical, is the mentoring and the induction. A few years back, I worked with some early career African-American teachers that had finished with me at another HBCU. And it was very disheartening to know how much work we had put on the front end of making them day one ready, only to hear about the isolation and some of those pieces that were happening to them in their first couple of years in the classroom once they went out in the district. And so at that time, we did exactly what she mentioned there. We would make sure that we pulled them back in and kept them in this, I don't want to say cocoon, but kind of a mentoring situation, which in the field, you know, we talk about it as the induction period because we technically are responsible for those folks that we graduate for 3 years. And that was before the state started monitoring it. The induction period says that we hold ourselves responsible for the graduates that we put out. And so the literature suggests that when we don't do that, they're particularly fragile. They're fragile anyway. But then what we observed there at that institution was that the candidates of color in certain classrooms in certain places were particularly vulnerable. So making sure that they're mentored, making sure that we're keeping those relationships with those graduates strong so that they are offloaded or transition into the classroom beyond those couple of years and don't leave when they get there. Yeah. It's so critical. As well as the second career piece, you know, our Masters of Arts in Teaching programs are extremely popular for that reason, because for lots of reasons, people find that teaching is a viable career, some earlier in life, some later in life. Mm-hmm. But making sure that individuals are very aware that we have lots of pathways in the profession and they're not all traditional. So if you have a degree from a regionally accredited university and you want to change a life, this is a way to do it. See an MAT, come through an MAT program and become a teacher.
Yeah, and I think that's what we have to market. But there are many pathways that folks don't think about. Before we get into educating in the pandemic, one of the things the pandemic has done on so many areas, it has shined a really bright light on the kind of the inequities that we have, the disparities that we have in so many ways. When we look at teaching, particularly in a large district that you have, Dr. Harrison, there's a lot of unevenness in terms of education and the quality of education and the educational outcomes. And I know that you have been working extremely hard to reduce those in those areas, looking at some of our schools in which students aren't performing well. You know, how do we get them up to par and how do we get them performing better? Interested in having you talk just a little bit about the work that you're doing in that area. I had a conversation with someone today, and I talked about how is it that we educate each and every child the exact same way to allow them to reach their full potential. And that means that we have to certainly get resources to some of these schools, but we also have to get, it's about leadership, it's about teaching. Talk a little bit about that and the work that you're doing.
Well, it goes back to how schools are identified, and oftentimes we realize that our newest, brightest teachers come out of school ready to make a difference, but they just don't have the experience needed to quickly move children where they need to go academically. Several children, your children are often, children are children. Some are high flyers, that they get it right off the bat. Some need more coaching. Some need more direct instruction. The way you teach children, it has to vary depending upon their need. And as we know, our new teachers are learning. They're in a learning mode. But oftentimes, they're recruited to our highest need schools. Oftentimes, our more veteran teachers are at our higher performing schools, and we need them at some of our schools with high needs. And so we've been making some changes in that area, talking and speaking to and getting our veteran leaders and veteran teachers to transfer to some of our lowest performing schools. And I should say underperforming schools, because they have the potential to do great things, but they sometimes aren't given the chance. And by nature, a divide is created based on parent income. You can teach children at the same levels with the same level of intensity, and a student with means and high income will attend summer camps, take language classes, participate in performing arts and arts classes outside of the classroom, because learning continues through the home, where children without means do not oftentimes have access to those opportunities. And so the appearance is of course, it seems like there's an inequity, but really it's the income of the family that is creating a greater divide. And so we have to rely on partners, community partners, to create those opportunities for children that may not exist because they just don't have the means. When you look at technology, we're probably using the type of technology now that we should have used 5 years ago. But children, as you have become aware, do not oftentimes have access to the internet at home, which has been a concern for educators for years now, because more of the learning is digital. More of our experiences are online. There's more virtual reality, more augmented reality that we're exposing children to, but our children can't go home to that. When you think about cyber and coding, you need home access. And that doesn't exist in a lot of our communities. So we are working very hard to give our children access in these times to do them up. But we're looking for these changes to be permanent, something that we provide for our children on a permanent basis. Children should not go home without internet access and access to learning because of their zip code.
Yeah, and that's great. And talk about Winston-Salem. And you mentioned a little bit about partnerships, but this is a very engaged community with you, Dr. Harrison, because they want to see us perform very well. They want our students to get the best. And so you've been able to really develop some great partnerships in this area to assist in some of the things we're talking about now.
I tell you, this is a great community. And as soon as you know, when you start to call names,
yes,
you
right.
know, you'll miss someone. And they'll say, she didn't remember that I did.
But, yes, right. but no, I don't do that. Tell you,
we have some children walking out of third grade. 93% of one of our elementary schools, 93% of the third graders leave third grade reading on grade level. But in the same district, we have one school, several actually, but one in particular, third grade reading, kids leave at maybe 7% of the children are leaving reading on grade level. And zero boys of color, Hispanic or African American, left third grade reading on grade level. What a travesty.
Yes.
And so our board has charged right away. They approved an equity policy, because really when we look at educating our children through the lens of equity, we know this is not acceptable. And so we've had great partners with you all, with the university, some of your students. I've been tutoring our students in our summer programs with our universities. We've had great corporate support. Project Impact has supported pre-K for us, as well as our textbook initiative. We had not had textbooks in many, many years. And we know for so many of our children, level readers, textbooks, access to technology, those are the resources they need. So we have been extremely blessed to have the YMCA, Imprints, CARES step up to the plate and help our children. So I can't say enough. And I've missed so many people. Our Winston-Salem Foundation has been tremendous in developing, granting our teachers professional development money to grant to grow capacity. So this community, our community here, Winston-Salem Forsyth, has been just tremendous since my since I came in the door. They've been great about you know. And then we have another group that works locally, bringing our community nonprofits together to look at wraparound service. Yes, that's another thing we miss. We were way off the mark with that. We miss the fact that if I have a child that is hungry and a child that doesn't have the social emotional, as you mentioned, needs met, or a parent who's working two and three jobs and who doesn't have the tutoring support, that child who's the diamond in the rough is going to miss out. So the wraparound services group that we met pre-COVID, hopefully that will come back together. I think we met about every week at 7 a.m. It was an early meeting, but they were good because we're bringing community resources together to work on behalf of children. Very exciting work going on in our district right now.
You know, I agree, and I've seen it up close and personal, the kind of support that we have in this community. Dr. Williams, at Winston-Salem State University, we have this social justice lens that we look through. And we like to think that we're preparing students to go into some of these hard to reach areas. And sometimes that's a challenge in and of itself, but we know that work has to be done. So talk a little bit about kind of your vision about where you want to go with your work at Winston-Salem State University.
Well, I think what I would say first is that I would continue to build on what I have found so far. You know, our programs here, as you mentioned, are socially justice oriented. And from the courses, the types of courses, I was just talking with a colleague, Dr. Tafari, a couple of days ago, and she leads a course on...
Isn't she great? She's one of my favorite people.
Oh my goodness, fantastic. The course that she does with the focus on African-American males, it's on site at one of the schools, and it's the push in tutoring piece where it was before COVID, you know, but we're making those tweaks as needed, but making sure that our candidates understand the culture, language, and cognition connection with their learners, that you can't separate out culture and language and think that you're going to achieve something with cognition, that it all works together, and making sure that they're using those practices that are culturally responsive, that they are understanding the role that culture plays, and that they're seeing that as a strength. You know, a lot of these resources that we need and our students need, if they're used or they're approached in ways that work from a deficit-based perspective, it will not be effective. When you talked about potential earlier, we must have individuals who believe there is potential. And so that, you know, whatever they're doing in that classroom, when they're planning their lessons and they're getting on Zooms now, that they're starting those class meetings with the belief that those children will be successful and they have the capacity. And that shift in belief, that shift in what it is we expect, the expectation for excellence comes from a different type of mindset. You know, social justice, cultural competence, culturally responsive pedagogy, those are those frameworks that our program stand on, and we'll continue to do that.
Great. Thank you so much for that. I have to get into what's happening now. So Dr. Harrison, take us through what the school year is gonna look like in this pandemic, because a lot of what happens with the school system impacts what happens at Winston-Salem State, particularly with our employees who have children in the system. What is this year gonna look like?
Well, at this time, we are in a virtual state of learning. We planned all summer to bring children back 2 days a week with the kindergarten through third grade students attending school every day. And then we shifted to a K-8 model, children in school every day with high school students online. But right there at the last moment, we realized when teachers began to ask for alternate assignments that we were not going to have the teaching going on that we thought we were. Our teachers were really, it's been a lot of talk around deaths and the data. So people are nervous, and we have to acknowledge that we cannot assume that their fears are not real. They're real to them. And so we really needed more time to work with our staff. We also realized that the dollars were not there to open safely the way we needed to open. So again, we began to look at what we call Plan C, which is online, and that's for 9 weeks, perhaps longer depending on the rate of infection in the community. And so everywhere I am, I encourage people to wear their mask. I encourage them to participate in lowering the numbers of community in the community of positive rates. Try to do everything we can because that means we can get back to face-to-face instruction. When numbers are high, it's really hard to convince teachers and children to go back into schools. So we anticipate a hybrid model at the end of the quarter. But we also are realistic and looking at other school districts and realize that there will be some level of closure throughout the face-to-face instruction. Children will come in with positive test rates of testing. Adults will end up testing positive, and we will have to adjust to that. But with the correct plan in place, the additional dollars that we will receive, we will be able to handle the closure appropriately. And also the online learning will enable us to continue learning, although we will need to close, and we realize we'll need to close periodically for additional cleaning and additional communication to families who might have been exposed to the virus. So it's going to be an on again, off again type of year that everyone needs to be prepared on throughout the year with their children, what will happen when we close. We actually have 6,000 students signed up for virtual who have said to us, in spite of the fact you plan to come back face-to-face, we will remain in the virtual world for learning, the online learning. So we realize we'll have a mixture of students and teachers in the classroom throughout the year. But we feel we're prepared, and we feel that we have a good plan, but we ask for patience. Yeah, people can be very impatient, so we ask for patience.
Yeah, yeah. And like you said at the beginning, you really do have a good staff and great partnerships.
Yes.
What, if anything, Dr. Harrison, are you doing around technology and making sure that folks have access to technology? And then one of the big issues people talk about, students needing return to school, nutrition, food. How, if any, are you handling those situations?
So we handed out 40,000 Chromebooks to, since 53,000 students. And so, we ensured the students who requested Chromebooks had Chromebooks. We also purchased Wi-Fi devices for access. We have 20 buses that will be in communities for children who need to get on a classroom bus to access, have better access.
Wow, a classroom bus. Talk about that.
Yeah. So we have 20 school buses we've outfitted with Wi-Fi devices, and they will be parked in communities. Up to 10 children can get on the buses. There'll be support systems on the bus, tutors. Children can get on the bus, and there'll be meal delivery sites so children can get their food. So we're excited to use our bus drivers because we're not transporting students. So we're glad to create classrooms in the community and may add more school buses. They make great classrooms. They're comfortable and lots of space. And children can spend as much time as they want on those classroom buses. We'll have level books on some of them. So if children finish their work, they can grab a book and read throughout the process. So we're real excited about the concept, but it will be a different way of learning and for our children.
I mean, that's wonderful. I am glad to hear that. Yeah. I mean, that's pretty cool to have a school bus like that. This may be a conversation between the two of you, but I'm wondering, in a virtual world, how does that impact something like student teaching?
We got that worked out. You want to address that or?
Well, I was going to say that student teaching, thankfully, will go on. Yeah. With the experiences leading up to it, those small field experiences leading up are where we'll have to make some adjustments on our side. And here at Winston-Salem State, we're bringing in other resources like Atlas software so that our candidates who are in that freshman, sophomore, early stages can watch national board certified teachers teach and then unpack that teaching against standards and explain why he or she made the decisions they made during that course of instruction. Trying to give them some snapshots at wonderful, masterful teaching as they make their way up to clinical or student teaching, because we recognize that for some of these folks, it will be a while if during their college career ever that they'll get to be in a physical classroom again. And then for student teaching, we've been working with the Winston-Salem Forsyth County Schools and our other partner districts where our student teachers are to set up the Canvas platforms to get them partnered with their clinical educator in the classroom, getting the access, the things like student data that we have to be sensitive about. Lots of arrangements have been made with EPPs like ours and districts like Winston-Salem State around the state to make sure that our student teachers can still have a quality experience and quote unquote get their feet wet in the profession before they get a license. What else were you going to add, Dr. Harrison?
Well, we're going to continue our student teaching process. We have our paperwork in order. We really look forward to our teachers coming on board. And teachers right out of college understand technology way more than we do. Students today, I mean, when we're struggling to put children in groups, let me show you what to do. Let me show you how to connect your Zoom to the television set and I pay all this, these fees and they can do it around, they can do workarounds, but I'm excited. I when I think about the opportunities for our mm-hmm. children, when we think about equity, just think about how this mode of teaching has opened the doors for so many children. For example, if I were a student in some of our schools, I could not have access to AP chemistry because AP chemistry is only offered in two or three of our high schools. Now I have access to AP chemistry in mm-hmm. every high school. So this online world, virtual world that we've been forced in will open doors for so many children to have access to coursework, a dance class that's in a school that they are not enrolled in. And it's going to force us to really think about the access levels in the home for children. It forces us into a whole other conversation about access to technology.
Yeah, I mean, I agree. I mean, that is a great point that you don't hear a lot. Really opening up opportunities that they wouldn't necessarily have. I mean, I like that approach. Dr. Williams, in terms of education, how has the pandemic, in fact, I know we talked about student teaching, but in terms of student preparation, what's happening, what's going on in that space?
You know, much the same. We are making sure that faculty have the resources and the tools to be able to continue to provide relevant examples of best practices in the classroom, but in this remote way. So making sure that we're getting access to platforms and software that allow faculty to do just that, making sure that we integrate software that allows them to take a candidate's video of them teaching a group of kids live from their phone using software and give them feedback within that video right there in real time or later when it's more convenient for them. But really looking at ways to not make the remote environment an obstacle, but look at it as an opportunity. So access to software, looking at more digital opportunities to give feedback and correction to candidates. Lots of migration in this period. And some of it has been swift and others will come along.
Yeah. How are folks accepting this new world that we've entered? And how are you engaging students and parents to help them really understand what's happening and what's going on, and how are you communicating to them that even in a virtual world, that you are doing everything that you can to make sure that students get a high quality education? Because I think at the end of the day, you know, that's what's important. And I believe that out of something like this, we get a lot of creativity, a lot of innovation that comes out of that. I'm wondering if the two of you have seen any of that in terms of as we prepare to enter into this new world.
You wanna start there?
Oh, yeah. Wow. You know, I think particularly in our field, you know, years ago, we started talking about the importance of the whole child, whole child, whole child. We wanted to make sure that those who were entering schools as leaders of classrooms and buildings and districts were aware that these children are more than an end of grade, end of course score. They are more than a one-off test that they take at the end of the semester or the year, but that we must remember that we are working with a whole person and looking at that social emotional piece. And so one of the things that has been encouraging in all this, from March when it all initially happened and we were shut down as institutions, is I've really seen faculty across institutions now since I've started here July 1, work really hard to ask the questions about what do our majors, what do our candidates need? Yes, we know we need their courses in Canvas by a certain time, and we want them to be clear about the expectations of the university, but what do they need right now to be okay? Are they okay? And we were in the middle of one of the advancement sessions, and I remember one of our chairs sending a note saying that she had checked in on some of the students just to make sure they were okay. And I know that for educator prep faculty, much like teachers in classrooms today, there's been this return to focusing on that mental health and stability and the care of our students. And, you know, whatever could force that into place and make that a priority, then it's welcomed here. Because at the end of the day, we are teaching people and other people's children, and we need to stay focused on that. And so that's where it appears a lot of the energy has been in the last couple of months from my observation.
And to that end, we're spending the first 2 weeks of our instruction, and I wouldn't call it instruction, but the first two weeks with our children, just working on that very thing, asking the question, how are you? How do you feel? How have things been for you? Trying to get them to open up about their emotions. You know, we as adults oftentimes are good about talking about our emotions, and then the children we expect just to move on. But we are, we're spending a lot of time getting to know our children again. But more than that, I think when parents opened the laptop this time and realized there was face-to-face instruction, they were happy. Last spring, we spent a lot of time on email, downloading documents, those kinds of things, but they liked the face-to-face. I watched a class today, and the teacher allowed the children an opportunity, allowed them 5 minutes just to unmute their video, unmute their mics, and just talk to one another. And you should have just seen them, you know, interacting. They don't really even know each other that well, but they wanted, what's your name and what's that behind you? And I see something in your bedroom or your class, you know, your dining. It was just exciting to see them talking to one another and having time for that socialization, which we know children need even virtually. But I think our parents understand that we must continue learning this year and certainly high quality. One of the initiatives we have is the CARES team project. We realize that so many parents will not engage in the process of getting kids online on a regular basis, because they just don't understand the importance, or they're just life just happens. Life is just happening to them. So our CARES team members are hired to be in the community, connecting to children, knocking on doors of families who have not logged in by the end of next week. So if you haven't logged in by the end of next week, we have someone coming to your house, and it will not be the FedEx guy. It will be a CARES team member to remind you of your obligation to get on with your teacher. And we have remote learning sites. Students can participate in learning and tutoring. And so we look forward to really helping our parents, not pointing fingers and judging, but helping them be better at helping their children learn virtually, because we know in the end we'll pay heavily if we don't engage children. And so our CARES team project will be that old-fashioned, homebound tutoring, teaching in the community, helping parents connect their technology in the homes if they're having trouble, and coaching our parents, and as well as reassuring them. So we are excited about the opportunities to support families during these times.
Well, I knew the hour was going to go by quickly. See, we're all already to the end of the hour. It's been a great conversation. I'm going to have you get us out of here. Well, tell me how you're different, one thing that you've learned, and then one piece of advice to folks as we're going through this pandemic. You can't stop at the end of the show. I mean, you got
that's a profound. You know, oh wow!
I've been reminded that there's so much good in mankind. There's so much good, and I think I've just been reminded of that through these times. And I walked back into my office one day and mail got backed up. And I know I had 10 cards from people who I've never met to say, you know, you're in our prayers. We want to support you any way we can, but just know you're in our prayers. And we thank you all for looking out for our children. People have come from everywhere just to say, I have some dollars I want to donate to the children. There's just so much good in mankind, and sometimes we forget that.
I like that. Last word, Dr. Williams.
That we are always, innovation is always there. And this entire experience has taught us that we can innovate and create, and we can find solutions when we must.
Thank you both for joining me. I am honored to know each of you and to work with you. I feel energized knowing that I have these partners working alongside of so many others in this area to make this thing work. So I'm energized, I'm excited about the school year. I tell our incoming first year students that in spite of all of this, I think that we're gonna have the best year ever. And I believe that, and you two of you are really great. So thanks for joining me.
Thank you.
Focus Now. Join us next week for another episode of Future Focus Now. Good night, everybody. Good night. Thank you.
Good night.